You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Wow. Look at what's going on in Italy, Greece, and the United States of America. Can you spell poison pill? They are huge and getting bigger. From our post office to our Medicare system to Greece's entire public sector to yesterday in Italy, the minister, their equivalent of the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, breaking down and sobbing while she was trying to explain that they are going to freeze pensions while inflation continues to rise. In other words, they're going to wipe out poor people, elderly people in Italy. Why? I'll explain in just a second. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and good Monday to you. How is what's going on in Europe the same as what's going on in the United States? Let me lay this out for you. This is not rocket science, but the corporate media, the mainstream media, the bank-owned and affiliated media is not discussing it. You are certainly not going to hear it on right-wing radio because, you know, of course, right-wing radio is part of that entire huge system as well. And this isn't like, hey, a weird conspiracy theory. No, it's right out in the open. Greece, when Papandreou, the Greek prime minister, said, okay, you want us to cut the pay of government employees. You want to cut the social security. They call them pensions in Europe. You want to cut the social security for everybody in the country. You want to take some of the landmarks of Greece that the Greek government has held for 3,000 years and sell them off to Chinese corporations, to German corporations, to American, to transnational corporations. You want to do all that in order to bail out our banksters because they got stuck with exploding debt as a result of Goldman Sachs committing a fraud. You want to do that? Those are the terms under which IMF will bail us out? Fine, let's put it to the people. Let's let the people vote on it. That's what Papandreou said. The day after he said that, he was no longer prime minister. Actually, it took 2 days. But the day after he said that, he went to that to the G20 meeting, and the next day he said, "Yeah, I'm going to resign." Who replaced him? He was not elected. He was appointed. The guy who replaced him, Lucas Papademos, is the former vice president of the European Central Bank. And he just says, okay, we're going to do it. Now, that was a couple of weeks ago. Then last week in Italy, then you know, shortly after that in Italy, the same thing happened. Silvio Berlusconi is given an ultimatum by the IMF. You will cut back on all social safety net programs. What we're seeing is the dismantlement of what used to be called democratic socialism in Europe. And it's being replaced with neoconservatism, neo-feudalism, with the new poor, Reaganomics, Thatcheronomics. Because frankly, a successful Europe is an embarrassment to the right-wingers who are pushing this stuff around the world. The banksters. So Berlusconi steps down and gets replaced by Mario Monti. Who is Mario Monti? Or Mario Monti, as the Italians would say. He is a former banker. I mean, it's really quite extraordinary when you consider what's going on. And who's he putting in charge of the government? Monti's ministers are all so-called technocrats. I mean, this is quite extraordinary. His cabinet does not include a single politician and not one person who's ever been elected by the people. Their obligation is not to report to the people of Italy. It's to report every 3 months to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. For example, the Minister of Economic Development, Corrado Passera, 57. He was previously the president of the second largest bank in Italy, Bank Intesa San Paolo. The Minister for Tourism and Sport, and the President of the State Energy Company, former President of the State Energy Company, Paolo Gannuti, 73. He's an economics professor at the University of Bologna. I go through the list here. Elsa Forno is taking over the Ministry of Labor and Social Affairs, former professor of economics. And she was on the board of the Intesa San Paolo Bank. It just goes on and on and on. You could just Google this stuff. But basically what's happening is, well, here, the Financial Times summarizes it well today. From goldsmiths to widget makers, entrepreneurs running the small businesses that form Italy's economic backbone are calling on Mario Monti's new government of technocrats to redress what they see as years of neglect under Silvio Berlusconi. Italy lurches into a recession. But small companies fear their needs will be overshadowed by the powerful lobbies of the big corporations. Monza's Chamber of Commerce calculates that 120,000 companies have gone out of business or failed in the last 12 months. The Italian government's putting into place reforms, okay? The Monti government's reforms are expected to remove the artificial restraints that encourage many companies to stay small. In other words, they're going to stop enforcing their version of the Sherman Trust Act, Antitrust Act, and let the Italian companies get really, really big. Which is a fancy way of saying let the big multinationals buy them out. Now, you will recall, last week we talked about how in India, the Singh government, Mr. Singh, who's the Prime Minister of India, he was going to try something on a variation of this. He was going to let foreign retailers own stores in India. Right now they do in most other countries in the world, but India has protected their economy. You have to have 51% Indian ownership. So Walmart has to have a partner. IKEA has to have a partner. Adidas has to have a partner. You name it. Nike has to have a partner. And the partner owns 51% and is Indian. And if you've ever run a small business, you know somebody owns 51%. They can do anything they want. They can take all the money. You got no say if it's not 50-50. If you only own 49%. And he has backed off from that now. So what's going on in the United States? Two poison pill pieces of legislation. And this is all part of the same, this is the same broad stroke that we're seeing in Europe. During the Bush administration, there were two poison pill pieces of legislation passed. The first one said that the post office has to take 75 years worth of health benefits for its workers, because it is the second largest employer in the United States behind Walmart and the number one largest unionized employer. 500,000 unionized employees. The Republicans wanted to destroy that union and destroy those employees. So they said that they have to fund 75 years worth of worker retirement benefits, that is, workers who are not even yet born, within a 10-year period, $5 billion a year. It's breaking the back of the post office. And then they passed Medicare Part D, and they said, oh, and for Medicare recipients, we're going to buy your drugs for you. But we're not going to raise taxes to pay for it. And we're not going to cut spending to pay for it. We're simply going to put it on the credit card. And eventually Medicare is going to be so broke that you're going to have to pay them instead of them paying you. In other words, it'll go out of business. And Medicare is approaching that. These were poison pill pieces of legislation. Do you see what's going on here? 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And then on top of that, say you want to protest these measures. State of Wisconsin wants you to pay to protest. Is this free speech? Welcome back. Tom Harvin here with you, the place where smart people get their news and strange goings-on in Wisconsin. Graham Zielinski is with us. He is the communications director for the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, wisdems.org, the website. Graham, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Do I get this right that the governor is now proposing that if four or more people want to protest in the state of Wisconsin, that they have to get a permit and they have to pay $50 an hour for every cop who shows up?
Yeah, I think that's right. You don't know these days what new crazy rule or piece of legislation is going to come down the pike, but it very much sounds like he wants protesters to pay. He wants the autistic kids who are coming from inner city Milwaukee. He wants poor people who may not have a place to stay. He wants all these folks, these ministers who are coming from all around the state to talk about him kicking kids off of Badger Care. He wants all these people to apparently pay to protest. So I think there's no room at the inn. He had a holiday tree that he insists on calling a Christmas tree, so I think he's kind of channeling his inner Herod here. There's no real room at the inn here in Wisconsin.
Amazing. The Bill of Rights. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech unless people pay a $50 per police officer fee in advance to the governor of the state of Wisconsin or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition their government for redress of grievances. I guess I missed that part in the First Amendment.
Yeah, well, one thing that we find comical here is that when the Tea Party angry folks came a couple years back, the Capitol remained open, the governor's office remained open, legislators' offices remained open, extra police were required, there were plenty of threats and insults made, but the Capitol remained free and open. Now when it's a different type of speech, a type of speech that apparently this thin-skinned governor doesn't like, then all sorts of restrictions are put on protest. All sorts of restrictions are put on speech. Let's not forget that at the height of the protests here, this is a governor who his administration jammed the internet frequencies here so that people couldn't communicate and organize here. This is somebody who, when he was in college at Marquette University, threw away newspapers that criticized him. He cannot brook criticism. He does not like dissent at all. And so he's put a price tag on it in a way that we think is plainly unconstitutional.
Sounds like a perfect and classic Republican candidate for pretty much anything.
Yeah.
Has the you must pay to protest, is this an executive order or is this a law? Has this gone into effect? Is anybody pushing back? I mean, or is this simply something that he's proposing?
Well, I think this is a dead letter. Let's hope at least it's a dead letter. Maybe it's a balloon. I don't know exactly the timeline for enacting these administrative rules. Look, he was already told by the court that he had to open up the Capitol. I mean, it was like a police state, like an armed encampment right after they shut it down, where you had a cop every 5 feet. And our Capitol was wide open. I mean, I interned there as a kid. I came here as a kid to go visit my state representative. It is really disturbing to see a democratic institution shut down like this, like it's some banana republic. And so we don't know exactly how this is going to play out. My assumption that this is just so rottenly unconstitutional, it'll go away. But with this governor, you never know.
Yeah. Graham Zielinski, how goes the, while we have you on, how goes the Recall Walker petition drive?
Sure.
I understand a couple of people have been arrested for defacing petitions or trying to sabotage the effort.
Yeah, but that's a small part of it. We don't believe that that's made a dent in the recall effort, which you can find more about at recallwalkerhq.com. But it's going very well. We take nothing for granted. Those last signatures are going to be very difficult to collect. We're also collecting signatures for three of the Senate races, and a fourth collection process is going underway in a fourth Senate district. So it's going very well. We're coming up on the holidays. Snows are coming here to Wisconsin, so we got to get our act together and get these signatures. 540,208 signatures is a huge number. We, as you know, are already halfway there, but we need a big cushion because it was just announced today that the Tea Party, funded by the Koch brothers, is going to be scrubbing these signatures. We fully anticipate them to be up to no good. This is a group that also wanted to cage African-American voters here in Milwaukee in a plainly illegal scheme here in Wisconsin before. So this is the same group that's up to it, and they're going to be futzing with the vetting the signatures. So we need extra signatures. We need all the resources we can get at recallwalkerhq.com, and we need your continued attention, Tom.
Now, back when William Rehnquist in the 1960s, when he was making his way up in the Republican Party, he started out in Arizona standing at polling places in Hispanic and Native American communities and challenging voters. And typically his challenge would be, on your registration card, it says that your name is Jim Johnson, let's say. But on your driver's license, it says you are James Johnson. Or on your utility bill, it says Jim Johnson. On your voter's registration, it says James Johnson. These are not the same, therefore you can't vote. And technically, Rehnquist was able to get thousands of Native Americans and Hispanics kicked off the voting rolls because of that exact type of variation. Is that the sort of thing that you're expecting the Tea Party is going to be trying to do?
Well, they've already done it by law here. They passed the most restrictive voter ID bill in the country here, and with all sorts of evidence that it would render ineligible huge percentages of African Americans, of Latinos, of Native Americans, of the elderly, of students, people who tend to vote for Democrats. So it starts at the top. It starts, but yes, we do expect that kind of funny business here, Tom.
Amazing, amazing. So people need to get out there. If our listeners and viewers in Wisconsin, get out there and get as many signatures as possible.
Yes.
And anybody else can help. What's the website again, Graham, real quick?
RecallWalkerHQ.com. We need your help.
Thank you. Thank you, Graham Selinsky.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
RecallWalkerHQ.com. And WisDems.org as well for the Wisconsin Dems. We'll be right back.
Listen up, Scott Walker, think you won this battle, but the people are tired of being treated like cattle. A few have been fooled and some have gone along, but the people of Madison are proud and strong. Wisconsin won't back down, know they'll stand and be heard. And way out here in Oakland, we're hearing their words. This ain't about a budget, we know money's tight. No, they won't stand for your lies, but we'll stand up for their rights.
Madison. Well, this is for the people in Madison.
Helping you with the water cooler wars. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So, let me just lay this out one more time very quickly. And, then we can carry on. But there's a lot in the news today. But the stuff that really I find most fascinating, in addition to the fact that the United Nations is now looking into police responses to Occupy Wall Street as suppression of freedom of speech in the United States, is that the post office is on the verge of shutting 4,000 local mail facilities and laying off 100,000 people out of its 500,000 or 600,000 unionized workforce. It is the second largest employer in the United States. It is the largest unionized employer in the United States. And therefore, the Republicans wanted to take them out. They passed this law 6 years ago, I think it was, that said that 75 years of worker retirement benefits, health benefits, have to be paid for upfront in a 10-year period. All the way up to 2080 something has to be paid for in a 10-year period. People who literally are not yet born yet, but maybe in 2050 or 2060 or 2070 will be working for the post office and retiring. Those benefits have to be paid for now. This is called a poison pill. Now, every time you hear reference to the post office on the media, I want you to listen carefully, because this is how this game is played here in the United States of America and around the world, frankly. In Italy, for example, when the Italian version of our Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare broke down crying yesterday as she tried to describe the fact that pensions are going to be frozen and they're not going to be indexed to inflation anymore, in other words, Social Security, no more cost of living adjustments, at a time when Italy is experiencing some inflation. In other words, elderly people are going to be totally screwed in Italy. She couldn't finish her sentence. She was sobbing. The prime minister is sitting next to her. The new prime minister just took over last week, the former vice president of a bank. And he says what she's trying to say is, you know, we're asking a little sacrifice from everybody. What he didn't add is, so we can pay the banksters. Here in the United States, when you hear news reports about the post office being in trouble or going under, notice how often they finish it by saying, because 6 years ago, a Republican Congress and a Republican president signed legislation requiring the post office to come up with $6 billion a year to fund, $5 to $6 billion a year, to fund 75 years worth of retirement health benefits in a 10-year period. Now, you will never hear it. That's why I say you should listen for it. Now, will you never hear it because our reporters in America are that stupid? That the news anchors on ABC, CBS, and NBC News and all the networks just don't know this? It's not inconceivable. There's no think tanks out there promoting the reality of this. About the only people talking out about it are the Postal Workers Union. We've had their representatives on this program 3 or 4 times. Or Medicare. Everybody's talking about, well, Medicare is running in a deficit right now. And have you heard anybody point out the reason for that deficit? Medicare was just fine until George Bush became president. And then a Republican president, a Republican Congress said, hey, you know, this Medicare thing, we love it so much, we're going to include free drugs. But we're going to do 2 things. We're going to force the government to pay full retail. So an aspirin that you could buy, you know, Medicare probably buys millions of aspirin a year. You could buy for a penny a piece. You're going to buy it retail for, you know, a brand name, what, 20 cents a tablet? Or penicillin, which is, you know, way generic, but you're going to have to buy a brand name one, or you're going to have to pay the full retail. Bottom line, full retail. You're going to have to pay full retail price. So it's a $600 billion subsidy to the pharmacy industry. Where's that $600 billion coming? It's actually $668 billion. Where's that $668 billion coming from? Out of Medicare. So when George W. Bush passed that Medicare Part D that funded the prescription drug program like that, and Democrats were afraid not to vote for it because, you know, who doesn't want to vote for Medicare to give away free drugs? And the Republicans knew this was a poison pill. This is going to kill Medicare. Now, there were a number of people who stood up and said, no, I'm not going to vote for this. Both Republicans who saw it as a budget buster and Democrats who saw it as a Medicare destroyer. But they didn't rule the day. And when you hear Medicare being discussed by the talking heads on TV or radio, or on right-wing talk radio in particular, do you ever hear them point out the fact that the reason that Medicare is in trouble is because of this poison pill? Or how about the poison pill of the Bush tax cuts? I think this is particularly interesting. Fred Upton was on Bloomberg over the weekend, I believe it was. Al Hunt, longtime Democratic commentator, saying, you know, before the Bush tax cuts, our economy was growing. Bush tax cuts go into place, our economy stops growing. What's that all about? Here's one of the lead Republican members of the House of Representatives pushing for more tax cuts to help our economy, who can't answer this simple question. Listen to this.
Why under those pre-Bush tax cut tax rates did the economy do so well in the 90s? And why under the Bush tax rates, less for the wealthy, to do so poorly in this decade?
Well, a couple things. One, spending went up. Right. You know, the wars, I mean, that's trillions of dollars. And also there was no change in the entitlements. And we also know...
But that shouldn't hurt the economy. That shouldn't hurt economic
growth.
Yeah,
but that impacts the debt.
Asking, why did the economy grow a lot? Why were more jobs created in the previous decade under higher taxes than in this decade under lower taxes?
I don't know specifically the answer to that question.
I just don't know. No Republican can answer that question. Why is it that the economy grew faster in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s when the top income tax rate was 91% up until 64 and dropped down to 74% and stayed there until Reagan dropped it down to 28% in 1986? Why is it that up until Reagan, when Reagan came into office in 81, he immediately dropped that top tax rate down to 50%, and guess what happened to the economy? Unemployment went from 7% up to 11%. Higher than it is now. What did Reagan do in response to that? He started spending like a drunken sailor. He went full-born Keynes. We've got to have a Star Wars program. We got to have this. We got to have that. They tripled the national debt. Tripled it. And you got people hysterical about the fact that Barack Obama is presiding over a $3 trillion budget. 60% of which is, you know, just normally paid for. Where's the other 40%? Why is it not being paid for? Well, a quarter of it is the Bush tax cuts. About a quarter of it is the fact that we're in a recession, so we're not getting the tax collections we would otherwise have. About a quarter of it is the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And this is simple math, but you will not hear this stuff laid out, you know, on right-wing talk radio or in corporate media, in mainstream media. On these Sunday news shows, none of these questions were asked by David Gregory on NBC over the weekend when he had the head of the RNC, Rince Priebus, on. Not one of them. Now, they don't want to talk about this. Instead, Donald Trump is going to host a Republican debate. And by the way, he's going to endorse somebody at the end of it. He's turned it into a circus already. I mean, this is mind-boggling. This is absolutely mind-boggling that a circus huckster, Donald Trump, whose claim to fame is that he inherited hundreds of millions of dollars from his daddy, nearly lost it all, went through a couple of bankruptcies, was able to get back on his feet. Much of his income is coming from his gig on NBC, Celebrity Apprentice. He's a huckster. And a birther. And he's going to host a Republican debate? Ron Paul has said, you know, this is beneath the office of the presidency. John Huntsman has agreed. They're not going to show up. Guess who embraced it? The guy who's not really running for president. He has no ground game. He's running for book tour. Newt Gingrich. He's like, I'll be there. Well, Newt's a huckster, too. Of course he'd be there. And Donald is on his, what, third, fourth, fifth wife? I don't know. Newt's on his third. I mean, of course, they'll have a great time.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Somehow I doubt at the very end that that Trump is going to say to Newt, Newt, you're fired. No, no.
Don't let the smooth talk fool you. Don't let the sharks get to you. Don't let them small minds out there on prime time make it jump out of you.
Now, let's see. Newt Gingrich will show up for Donald Trump's gig because they're both serial adulterers or serial marriers. What would you call that? Serial polygamy? I guess so. Legal polygamy? I don't know. Anyhow, Gingrich and Trump have that in common. What do Romney and Trump have in common, though, that would cause Romney to show up? Oh, I know. They're both part of the 1%. So maybe Romney and Gingrich will show up. We'll see. Here's clip number 7. This is Buddy Romer, who is a Republican candidate for president. They won't let him into the Republican debates because he won't take corporate money, and they're all sponsored by corporations so far, as best I can tell, either corporations or rich guys who fund think tanks and things like that. Here's Buddy Romer's thoughts on Romney and Gingrich.
Look, There's a difference between the 1% who rule the country and the 99% who suffer their mistakes. I believe that Mitt Romney represents the 1%, and I believe that Newt Gingrich is the lobbyist.
There you
for
go,
the
right
1.
There, and is the lobbyist for the 1%. You got it. Mike in Albuquerque. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm just wondering if anybody listening to what's going on in Europe right now, if people even understand it.
They do. That's why they're in the streets.
I wonder if they remember a guy named Dominic Strauss-Kahn, who was basically railroaded out of his position at the IMF through a scandal so that they could clear the way for somebody who would actually go along.
It's looking that way, yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, let's put all the pieces together. Let's just wait for his book, I guess. But, you know, what it says to me is in Europe, it takes serious coup d'etat type activity to get people out of office so that they can put people into office who will comply with the banksters.
Yeah.
And here in America, they don't have to get rid of anybody. Everybody's already on board.
Yeah. I think what you're seeing here is the vision that Neville Chamberlain had, which is that Germany and the United Kingdom would join forces to be the empire that would rule Europe. And that Germany, all these years after the fact, is basically winning World War II. And Angela Merkel, I mean, Germany has the resources. And what they want to do is they want to create this hard currency part of the Eurozone, the internal part, the strong countries, and then the soft currency part of the Eurozone, the weaker countries. And basically what they're creating is sort of like a United States of America with Mexico attached to it, and Mexico is the factory floor. It was the vision of NAFTA. NAFTA was, let's let the Mexicans be the cheap labor for the United States and Canada, and that way we can elevate our standard of living because we can get cheaper goods. Nobody kind of put two and two together that you actually need to be doing manufacturing. And frankly, I think that that's going to be the disaster that they're going to have in Europe as well. But yeah, that's what's going on in the Eurozone. Kenny in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Kenny, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. And thanks for everything you do. You're really a wealth of information.
It's an honor to be here, Kenny. What's up?
And anyways, yeah, I had some questions about this. You know, I was looking this up at Thomas's, the bill, the Postal Service bill.
Yeah.
It's called the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act.
That's right.
H.R. 6407. And what I see on here are, you know, I'm a Democrat myself, dyed in the wool. I see a lot of Democrats. Henry Waxman is a co-sponsor. And Danny Davis from Illinois, I think, I'm pretty sure he was a Democrat. Now, the guy that sponsored this was Tom Davis. Now, I don't know if he was from Virginia. I think he was a Republican.
Yeah. I don't know. I can't speak to the original piece of legislation. I don't know how it began. Very often, legislation will start out really good, and then you get all these riders attached to it, and whether this was an amendment that was slapped on the tail end of it or not, I don't know the legislative process. I can tell you right now, regardless of who did it, and whenever somebody says I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat, I assume that it's a Republican caller. In any case, I don't know who did it, but I can tell you this was a piece of legislation that was designed to destroy the post office, and it is. It's just doing it. Robert in Meridian, Texas. Hey, Robert.
Hey, Tom. I wanted to talk about this thing about the first-class postal mail.
Yeah.
First, I get paid twice a month. Unfortunately, I don't have direct deposit, so it would be nice if I had direct deposit so I could pay my bills even sooner. What about the other problem? I know I get my bills every 30 days. What about if I buy a product and then they send this bill 25 days later and I got 3 days left? You know, the last time.
You know, the insurance companies are already playing that game, you know, with anybody that they really don't want to be insuring because they've got a chronic disease or something. They send the bill out 5 days before it's due or whatever. Some of the insurance companies, at least one that I know of. So, Robert, yeah, there's some serious issues around this, but it's a mess. Larry in New Orleans. Hey, Larry. Stop saving capitalism?
Yes. Hey, Tom. I've been listening to you since the day after a Franken factor went off the air, and yes, I disagree. We should stop saving capitalism. Now, you've mentioned several times that, you know, pure capitalism, it can't stand on its own. You use the examples of Somalia and the Gilded Age.
Laissez-faire capitalism. Laissez-faire
capitalism,
right.
Laissez-faire, right.
It always produces an autocracy.
Capitalism has to constantly save from itself. You know, as you admit, capitalism requires inefficiency, waste, and redundancy to generate full employment. And because of its inherent and fundamental conflicts of interest, capitalism has to be heavily regulated. But no matter how regulated, capitalism is ultimately unsustainable because, as you've mentioned, capitalism always tends towards oligarchy and monopoly. It undermines the will of the people. You gave examples this morning of Greece and
Larry, here's the simple thing. The problem is when capitalism contaminates politics. Capitalism is not a political system. It's an economic system. I am a fan of, for example, worker-owned cooperatives, which is not capitalism. And there are a lot of good alternatives to capitalism. I wrote about Mondragon as the last chapter in my book Threshold, which is the world's largest worker-owned cooperative. There are a lot of alternatives to capitalism out there, but you're not going to stamp capitalism out tomorrow morning. And communism is not going to solve the problem either. This has to do with politics. Up next, who's been naughty or nice? Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. In the first hour of our program, I went through a fairly detailed comparison of the poison pill efforts of the Republicans to destroy both Medicare and the Postal Service, or at least the unions, the Postal Service being the largest unionized employer in the United States, destroy the unions, and what's going on in Italy, where the Italian equivalent of health, education, and welfare secretary yesterday, as she was announcing that as part of their austerity plans, they're going to have to cut pensions, also known as Social Security. They're going to have to freeze them during a time of inflation. She broke down and started crying. She couldn't finish her sentence. The new prime minister, who, by the way, used to be a banker, finished the sentence for her. It's like the rise of the banksters. The banksters in Greece have taken over. The banksters have now taken over Italy. Germany, frankly, I think, is going to have one World War II before we see this over. So, anyhow, we'll get back to that in some part. But right now, Brian Fisher is on the line with us. The Fox News' war on Christmas seems to be well underway, and the American Family Association has jumped on board. AFA.net is their website. Brian is the director of issue analysis. Brian, welcome back. And the host of the Focal Point radio program on the FR Talk Network. Brian, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
So you guys have compiled a list of companies who are, do I get this right, pro-Christmas versus anti-Christmas?
This is a true fact.
Okay. Tell me how this works.
Well, we look at the advertising that companies do this time of year, and the ones that use Christmas on a regular basis, we green light them. The ones that refer to Christmas only infrequently get a yellow light, and those that use Christmas sparingly or not at all, they go in the red column.
So the American Family Association and you, Brian, believe that when Jesus said you have to choose between God or mammon, which is, you know, money and the things and commerce, that he was, what, lying or just mistaken?
I'm sorry. Say that again.
Jesus made it very clear that you could choose between getting rich or you could choose between being virtuous and holy. You could
Tom. So you're saying that if you don't use the word Christmas to describe the Christmas holiday, that there's something virtuous and righteous about that?
What I am saying is that a company that uses Jesus Christ to hustle goods is profaning his name and the work that he did. Yes.
You know, Tom, I got to tell you, I am delighted. I am delighted to hear that you are concerned about people profaning the name of Jesus Christ. This is a breakthrough.
I'm a Christian, and I am horrified when people, when for example, Republicans stand up and call themselves Christians and then say, and then completely forget about Matthew 25, the one time in the entire New Testament where the disciples came to Jesus and said, how do we get into heaven? And he said, feed the hungry, heal the sick, clothe the naked. In other words, house the homeless, visit those in prison. And they all freaked out and said, you know, that we're screwed. We'll never make it into heaven, you know, because we've never seen you. He said, at the last days, I'll be sitting there judging the sheep from the goats. I'm sure you're familiar with Matthew 25.
Oh, sure.
And they said, we've never seen you hungry. We've never seen you naked. We've never seen you sick. How are we going to get into heaven? And he said, as you've done to the least of these, my brethren, you've done unto me. And then I see Republicans standing up on the floor of the House of Representatives and people like your organization, the American Family Association, saying, oh, well, we've got to cut these social safety net programs, which is the essence of what Jesus said you've got to do to get into heaven, and instead replace them with tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. And by the way, let's help Macy's make an extra $1 billion, and let's make sure that Walmart makes an extra $1 billion. Their multi-billionaire owners are really good Christians, and let's use the name of Jesus Christ to do that. It makes me want to puke, Brian. I think that what you are doing is blasphemous.
Well, Tom, I just got to tell you, I am so heartened to hear you so worked up over blaspheming the name of Christ. I've never heard this coming from you before, and you know,
I'm astounded that you're not ashamed and humiliated that you have been called out for blaspheming the name of Christ.
Barack Obama, last spring, he would not even issue a proclamation in connection with the Easter.
Brian, I am astounded that you are trying to change the subject away from the fact that the American Family Association is promoting blasphemy.
Well, Tom, like I say, I think that's terrific that you're concerned about blasphemy. And the other thing,
why are you not answering the question? Why is the American Family Association promoting blasphemy?
What we are doing is promoting the day that our nation has set aside to honor the birth of Jesus.
Not true.
Christ.
If you were doing that, you'd be out, you know, buying advertising or putting out signs saying, please honor Jesus Christ. Instead, what you're doing is you're saying, we're going to put a gold star by the name of corporations that make a profit by using the name of Jesus Christ. And that is blasphemy. And I don't get it how you guys can even call yourselves Christians and do that.
Well, Tom, number one, I got to take issue with your interpretation of what Jesus said there. That instruction to clothe the naked and to feed the hungry and to shelter the poor, that was not a command that Jesus gave to government. It's a command that he gave to you and to me. And Christians are doing those things every day of the week, 24/7.
You are not government, Brian. Neither one of us are government. You are the American Family Association. And what you guys are doing is you are promoting big corporations making more profits and using the name of Christ to do it. And, you know, I got to tell you, as a Christian, I'm horrified by this.
Well,
I'm guessing there's a lot of Christians across America who are looking at the American Family Association joining up with the largest corporations in America. And I'm wondering, are you guys getting a kickback from these companies?
Not a dime. We're doing it for the cause, Tom.
Okay, well, what's the cause?
The cause is to protect the day.
The cause is to commercialize Christmas?
No, the cause is to protect the day that the United States of America has set aside to honor the person of Jesus Christ.
And you're going
to
protect that by saying, buy more crap made in China? I don't understand why you're laughing,
Tom,
Brian. This is serious stuff.
No, because Tom, these companies, this has nothing to do with corporate profits. This has to do with the fact that these companies are censoring the name of Christ. They're censoring the word Christmas. It's what we're concerned about is the anti-Christian bias that these companies are representing.
Brian, I am not going to use my religion, my spirituality, my whatever, as a way to hustle my radio show. Does that make me anti-Christian?
No, I just got to tell you, Tom, I'm excited that you're so concerned about profaning the name of Christ. I love it.
I'm astounded that you're doing it.
No, we're trying to keep it from being done.
You are absolutely doing it, Brian.
Trying to keep it from being done.
You will not answer the hard questions. Should, you know,
What's the hard question, Tom? I don't get it.
The hard question is, why are you willing to say that Why is it that you're elevating commercialism, which Jesus explicitly opposed? Why are you elevating that as a way of promoting Christianity when, in fact, that is it's antithetical to the message of Christianity?
Well, first of all, Christ is not opposed to commercialism. You know, when he told the parable of the talents, he gave varying amounts of talents to his employees based on their skills.
That had nothing
ability.
To do with employees.
And
that
he
was.
Says, I want you to go out and I want you to invest this and I want you to make money. That, and when I come back, I'm going to evaluate the rate of return that you got on what I entrusted
you. You and I both Jesus know that that
Jesus
parable
was
not
at all opposed to enterprise. He's not opposed to capitalism. He's not opposed to free enterprise. He's not opposed to making a profit. In fact, the guy.
And if you made a big profit and became a rich man, you could slip through that needle's eye.
Jesus said, "You're a wicked and lazy slave because you did not put the money to work that I gave you to generate more profit." So,
Brian, if that parable, which it can be interpreted a dozen different ways, if that parable is your interpretation of Christianity, you know, God bless you, my brother. I am so sorry. I will pray for your soul. I am so sorry to hear that.
Well, Tom,
Brian Fisher, blasphemer with AFA.net.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is tragic. This is just absolutely tragic that people would use the name of Christ to promote commercialism. Welcome back. It just blows my mind. The parable of the talents was basically Jesus' way of saying, you know, if you don't use your life to do good, you're screwed. And these guys are turning this into, enough religion. Let's talk about what's going on the other side of the planet and happening here. I had my Geiger counter arrived in the mail last week. Honest to goodness, I bought a Geiger counter. And it arrived, and I'm walking around Washington, D.C. with this Geiger counter looking for hot spots. And I want to walk into the supermarket, and Louise is like, "You have to put that back in your pocket." She's terrified that the FBI or something is going to think that I'm looking for a spot to put a dirty bomb or something. So I've got a Geiger counter, but my wife won't let me use it. Maybe I should, though. Kevin Camps is with Beyond Nuclear. BeyondNuclear.org is the website. The Fukushima China Syndrome and the architect of Reactor 3 are warning of more to come. Plus, there's leaks going on. Kevin, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
If my wife would let me use my Geiger counter, and if I was to go down to the supermarket and find some fish that originated from Southeast Asia, as so much of it does, you think I might find some radiation?
Well, you know, actually, you need to do special tests with much more expensive radiation monitors and
this is almost $400.
Equipment. Yeah, I hear you.
It catches cosmic radiation.
Find the internal contamination in those fish, which is almost certainly there if they're coming from the Japan East Coast, is to do an analysis in the laboratory, which our federal government, which has the resources, has the equipment, has refused to do from the beginning. And then you're going to start to see the internal contamination.
Yikes. Okay. So what's going on with Fukushima right now?
Well, some very disconcerting news. Tokyo Electric Power Company, nearly 9 months after the meltdowns took place, is now admitting how bad they actually have been. So in Unit 1, which was the first to melt down, they're saying is probably the worst of the three reactor meltdowns. They're admitting that there has been very deep melt through of not only the reactor pressure vessel in Unit 1, but also deep into the concrete primary containment structure. And they're admitting that there's only a foot and a half of concrete left before the final layer of steel. And then it's a pretty short course into the environment, into the soil, into the groundwater at that point. And bear in mind, this is all a computer simulation by Tokyo Electric Power Company. So what kind of shenanigans they're playing with the computer modeling. But they're admitting that they are very close to the final steel barrier to prevent penetration of the earth, which is, by definition, the China syndrome.
And my recollection of the China syndrome, so basically, in English, what we have here is a molten mass of white-hot radioactive material that used to be the fuel rods, you know, sitting on the floor of the reactor and burning its way through the floor of the reactor. And then it'll burn its way through the steel, it'll burn its way through the concrete underneath, and it'll start burning its way through the rock until it hits a layer of water. And since this is right next to the ocean, that's probably not more than 5-10 feet down. And when it hits that layer of water, it's really hot, the water's really cold, you get something called a steam explosion, and it just blows the hell out of the whole thing. Do I have that right?
Yeah. The architect of Unit 3 at Fukushima Daiichi, a former president of Saga University, so impeccable academic credentials, has said that it's just a matter of time before the molten core, at least in Unit 1, if not also Units 2 and 3, does reach groundwater. And then if it just hits it right and there's enough water and enough molten core, you're going to have a pretty powerful steam explosion. So yet more catastrophic radioactivity releases in a great big hurry. But you've also got just the chronic flow from this site into the ocean, for example. So, you know, even the decontamination system, which is supposed to be taking radioactive contamination out of the cooling water, which is massive in quantity, they're admitting now that they have leaked tens of tons of radioactively contaminated water from that system into the ocean.
Right, where it gets into the food chain, and ultimately it ends up in the fish, and it ends up in my restaurant, and maybe in a quiet corner of the restaurant, Louisa, let me take the Geiger counter out and measure the fish. We'll see. But question, the Chernobyl melted down. I mean, there was a full core meltdown, was there not?
There was more than one massive explosion and then a fire that burned for 10 days. And so, yes, there was a massive meltdown, too, that they were finally able to stop before going any deeper.
So how did they stop the melting core at Chernobyl from melting down through the earth and hitting a water level? And why can't they do the same thing at Fukushima?
At Chernobyl, they brought in hundreds of miners from Siberia, and in an emergency operation that was round the clock for I don't know how many days, they drilled a tunnel under the Chernobyl reactor building, and they poured massive amounts of liquid nitrogen into the ground to freeze the ground, to freeze the groundwater, and prevent the molten core from reaching any deeper. And so that's a good question at Fukushima. I am not a geologist, but I imagine the proximity to the ocean, very different than Chernobyl, may have complicated such an operation because, like you said, there's a lot of groundwater and there's even the ocean right there. So how they're going to get under the reactor in a great big hurry. But they've had 9 months to figure this out. And so the professor from Saga University.
But they can't get this stuff out. It's not like you can go in with a dump truck and just pull it out. I mean, any scoop you put in to grab that molten core, it'll melt right through it.
Well, yes, and at Chernobyl, they got under the meltdown is what they did. They got out in front of it, so to speak.
Right. And they can't do that here. So how many? Yeah. We've got six reactors at Fukushima. We just have a couple seconds, Kevin. Six reactors at Fukushima. How many have had meltdowns? How many of these might end up with China syndromes?
Three of them, units 1, 2, and 3. And then you got the high-level radioactive waste storage pool at unit 4. More and more evidence that there was a fire and catastrophic radioactivity release from that pool.
Wow. So, and each one could be a Chernobyl, essentially.
It's approaching Chernobyl in scale and has matched it and exceeded it in terms of certain radioisotopes. Xenon-133, the releases have been
You're
greater.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
That's amazing. Kevin Camps, beyondnuclear.org. You can get all the information there. Kevin, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking.
He's making a list and checking it twice. Gonna find
Jacob, you're going to go to hell for that. Oh, wait a minute. That was not Jesus. That was Santa. That's the secular version of Christmas, isn't it? Okay. I think Jacob is going to fall off his chair. He's laughing so hard. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Greg in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Hey, Greg, what's on your mind today?
Hey, two things, sir. It's great to hear from you, but that guy was such a hypocrite that was on your show that said he was a Christian. That's a joke.
The American Family Association. I'm telling you, they're all over Fox News. They're fueling the war on Christmas. They're all over the national media. They've got this list of companies that say, you know, that say Christmas a lot in their advertising, and they give them, you know, gold stars or green stars or whatever, green lights. And they got this list of companies that don't mention Christmas very often, and they give them yellow lights or red lights if they don't mention Christmas enough to sell their stuff, which is not what this holiday should be about.
And one other thing, Newt Gingrich, how can he get kicked out of his job and then now he's going to be wannabe president.
That's a good question. Nobody's raised the fact that Newt Gingrich left Congress under a cloud as a result of Jim McDermott, Congressman Jim McDermott, releasing the audio tape of Newt Gingrich committing a criminal conspiracy over a cell phone. And that's why he left Congress. I mean, it's to the best of my recollection. And that'll come out if he becomes the nominee, I guarantee. I mean, I'm telling you,
How could he even be running?
He's not running.
Republicans.
He's not running. There was an article in the New York Times this morning. I remember, I pulled this thing out and I handed it to Louise. I said, see, we were reading the New York Times this morning, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock this morning, doing show prep. And I said, look at this article here. Newt is scrambling to create on the ground organizations around the country. Because he doesn't have any. Because up until now, he has not been running. Up until now, he has not been running for president. He's been running for book tour.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you
so much for everything you do.
You're welcome. Thank you, Greg, for the call. I appreciate it. It makes my head explode. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Not too much. I'd like to speak to the post office.
In the last hour, just for people who don't know what we're talking about, let me just set this up real quickly, Corky, and then I'll throw it to you. In the last hour, I pointed out that Europe is having all these poison pills. Basically, Europe is being taken down by the banksters and by Germany, and they put a bankster in charge of Italy this last week. They put a bankster in charge of Greece the week before last, and here in the United States, during the Bush administration, there were two pieces of poison pill legislation. The first was the one that said that the post office has to fund its health care benefits for 75 years over a 10-year period, which is bankrupting the post office right now. And the second was Medicare Part D, which said we're going to give free drugs and to all the Medicare recipients. However, we're not going to raise taxes to pay for it. And the government has to pay full retail price. So basically, it was designed to destroy Medicare. These were both pieces of legislation that came out of Republican Congresses signed by George W. Bush. So the reason why they want to take down the post office is because it's the second largest employer in the United States behind Walmart, and Walmart's not unionized, so it is the largest unionized employer in the United States, between 500,000 and 600,000 unionized employees, and that's the target for the Republicans. Take out that union. Now, let me throw it to you, Corky. It's all yours.
Well, the reason why they're trying to take out the union is because the union speaks with one voice, and that's a threat to the powers that be. They can't have people united, as we've seen throughout history. Whenever a people is united, the powers that be attack that organization because they want you to be an individual.
Well, it's also that the unions are democratic institutions. They elect their leaders. They define their own rules. They create their own bylaws.
Right.
And they can't stand democracy in the workplace. And a union is democracy in the workplace.
Right. Now, what you're going to have to speak to after I make the statement is to educate your listeners as to what a foreshadowment is.
Mm-hmm.
A foreshadowment, we had this back 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago. They told us what was coming. Remember when they changed the Army's advertisement and motto to an army of one? In other words, you don't have to belong to a group.
Right. The Army is the most socialist institution in the United States. It provides you with your clothing, it provides you with your meals, it provides you with your medical care, and it provides you with your housing. It's almost like the old Soviet Union.
And they told you that this was the foreshadowment as to we were going to break up everything that speaks with one voice.
That's interesting.
People that speaks with one voice, we're going to break that up. You're all going to be individuals with the voice of your own. You don't need to belong to a group.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, they stand as a group with their money and power to come against the people, to destroy the social fabric of the country that we have established through the years. This is an all-out assault. This is the war that's being waged around the world to finally take out the middle class of every nation around the world so that the powers that be can rule
Without those pesky middle class people trying to fight back or have elections. Very well said, Corky. Thank you very much. That's why I subtitled my book Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and How You Can Fight Back. And I wrote that book 5 years ago, and it still stands. Adam in Redondo Beach, California. Hey, Adam, what's up?
Hey, actually, it's Ed. But
Ed, my apologies.
You, Tom. Yeah, no problem. Your conversation with that American Family Association fellow, I think, brought something really important
Brian Fisher.
Out. Once upon a time, a long time ago, I had a conservative girlfriend, and we had the same exact argument over the three talents parable. And the thing is that parables, by definition, are intended to be read as metaphor.
That's right.
And yet, there's a whole branch of fundamentalism that reads everything in the Bible, including the parables, literally. And so, you know, they use that parable as a citation of, you know, showing that, Jesus endorses capitalism.
Right. Let me do a reality check with you, Ed. Let me tell you my interpretation of that parable, and you can tell me if I'm nuts or not. Because that parable basically is, you know, the wealthy owner or whatever gives to his sons, I think it was, his three sons?
Three servants, actually.
Three servants. Yeah. Okay, yeah. He gives them, different amounts of money, and one of them hides it, and one of them invests it, and one of them spends it, or some whatever it was. And basically, the bottom line is Jesus says to those who much is given, much is expected, and to those little is given, little is expected, and he rewards the guy who made the greatest profit. And my interpretation of that is, if you are, by virtue of the circumstances of your birth, and I consider myself one of those people, frankly, in a position where you can influence other people. You know, I can write books. I'm on the radio, whatever. If you are in your life in a situation where you can do good, and all of us can do good somehow, you know, we're all blessed here in America in ways that a person born in the slums of Delhi, India is not blessed. If you are born with that blessing, you have an obligation to multiply that blessing. In other words, to help other people, to make the world a better place. And if you don't do the, and to those whom much is given, which is us in America, much is expected. We should be helping the world. We should be helping others. Rather than just getting rich. That's my read of that parable. You tell me if you think I'm crazy.
I have a very similar read. I kind of think of it more in terms of the gift of life and God's love and whether you spread it around and multiply that in the world, or whether the servant that is cast out and punished is the one that just sits on it and doesn't put
right.
work in the world. And
right.
So yeah, and it, but
yeah, which in my mind is the Republicans who say, oh, you know, we've got money, we've got power, screw the poor.
Right. Exactly. The literal reading is, if you read it literally, it can be twisted to be an endorsement of make as much money as you can, buddy.
Yeah.
You know, because God will reward the rich.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of things that you can read literally in the Bible, and they end up being really, really creepy. But parable, as you say, parable is a metaphor. Ed, thank you very much for the call. I do appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Sarah in Tobahana, Pennsylvania. Am I saying that right, Sarah?
Toby Hanna.
Toby Hanna. Hey.
I'm a female last time I checked.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks, Sarah.
Anyway,
what's up?
I think you're spot on. I mean, I'm agnostic myself, but I do believe that if there was a Jesus and the things that Jesus said, help the poor, I don't see how anyone can say that, you know, with this department store, the story that this man was pushing. I have seen children through the years who come from families who call themselves Christians, and the children don't even know that Christmas has anything to do with Jesus. They think it has something to do with Santa Claus, and I find that really strange. And I think that your guest that was on the phone, to me, it would be better if he would make like a warm-hearted request. If he's so concerned about Jesus, maybe he'll encourage people to go to church.
Yeah. Yeah,
and really
exactly.
celebrate Jesus' birthday.
Or pray.
Or
help the poor. Or
exactly,
feed the hungry. Show up
exactly.
at a soup kitchen. Show up
right.
at a homeless shelter and volunteer, you know, four
exactly.
days of your time over the holidays. I mean, these are the things that if, you know, but no, he's saying, Macy's is good because they use the word Christmas a lot and Walmart isn't, so or whatever. I don't have his list in front of me, the companies.
Right. I think that's disgusting. I really think it's disgusting. Like I said, I'm not a religious person, but I think that's really disgusting.
Yeah, I find it at least bizarre. Sarah, thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. AC in Tampa. Whoop, I'm sorry, AC, let me put you on hold. I missed that break. I missed that cue. It is 45 minutes past the hour. We're taking a quick break. We'll be right back here on the Tom Hartman program. Gingrich, by the way, has unveiled a new child labor plan. Really? Make him work as apprentice for Trump? Really? I'll tell you all about that. And Peter Farrar is going to be by at the top of the next hour. He wants to shred the social safety.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Really? Child labor? Donald Trump? Newt Gingrich? Yeah. Well, they had a summit today. Newt Gingrich, who's on a book tour, he's out hustling books, and you know he's got to pay Calista's $1 million line of credit at Tiffany's, and he sat down with real estate mogul Donald Trump this morning to what? I don't know. Kiss his ring. He says, "I'm a big fan of him," Gingrich says of Trump after the meeting. Right. Well, actually, Buddy Romer had something to say about that. Clip number 7, Jacob. This is what Buddy Romer had to say. What? No, actually, that's not it. Which clip is the one about? Clip 2. That's John Huntsman. Thank you very much. Clip number 2. John Huntsman had something to say about going and kissing Donald Trump's ring. Here he is.
Well, I'm not going to kiss his ring. And I'm not going to kiss any other part of his anatomy. This is exactly what is wrong with politics. It's show business over substance. If he had any courage at all, he would be running for president of the United States of America as opposed to manipulating the process from the outside. This is about real issues. It's not about show business. The presidency of the United States of America is more important than these silly game shows and reality shows.
So there you go. And I agree with John Huntsman, and he's not going to show up for this thing. Now, here's what's particularly weird. When I first read this, I thought it was a joke. I thought it was a parody. But when Newt and Donald Trump sat down together, they decided to put together a program called, they're going to select 10, I'll just read this from Think Progress blog. After the summit today, this is Newt and Donald Trump sitting down this morning, Gingrich and Trump announced a joint plan to select 10 apprentice, as Trump put it, the actual plural of apprentices, but I guess they tried to Latinize it, from New York City's schools to work for the reality TV star. It was Newt's idea, and I thought it was a great idea, Trump said at a joint press conference. Obvious branding aside, this is Politico's Maggie Haberman, the obvious branding aside, it's not immediately clear that the New York City Department of Education will be interested. They're talking about no matter how well-intentioned, 10 students is less than a drop in the ocean. New York school system has about 1.25 million, 29% of whom are impoverished, according to Bloomberg News. And these apprentices are going to do what? We don't know yet. Donald Trump going to have them clean the toilets in Trump Towers? Maybe? Meanwhile, as the news is covering all this kind of thing, the richest one-tenth of the population makes about 9 times as much as the poorest one-tenth, a significant increase in the gap between the two from the 1980s before Reagan. This is what we're seeing, 30 years of Reaganomics. The gap between rich and poor is widening across most developed economies as skilled workers reap more rewards and top executives and bankers benefit from a global job market, the OECD said. It's just incredible. The earning multiple is 14 to 1 in the U.S. and Israel, 10 to 1 in the U.K., 6 to 1 in Italy and Japan. 10 to 1 in the U.K., Italy and Japan, and 6 to 1 in Germany and Denmark. Mind-boggling. Susan in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Susan, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Susan.
I wanted to tell you about my uncle. He was actually the media representative and public relations representative for Babcock & Wilcox, which manufactures and sells nuclear power plants.
Right.
They couldn't find what he had for 9 years. He finally was diagnosed with PSP, which is progressive supranuclear palsy. He had so much arsenic in him that they actually accused my aunt of poisoning him which he was the love of her life, she would never have done.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, PSP, I don't know if you know about it.
I don't.
You actually become trapped in your body. He had his mind, but he couldn't focus his eyes.
But he was locked in. So what does this have to do with nuclear power?
Well, we believe that because he traveled from power plant, that that's how he got it.
Amazing.
My family lives in Seattle, and this is my mother's brother, and I'm so terrified about all of the nuclear waste that is coming through the Pacific and that it's going to affect my family on the West Coast.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I have family on the West Coast too, Susan, and I'm concerned about it. In fact, I bought a Geiger counter and sent it to my kids and said,
yeah, well,
you know,
family in
check
Oregon
out
too.
Your food. Yeah. And I said, check out your food. But Susan, on the one hand, you know, we should take reasonable precautions, and I'm not eating, you know, I eat low on the food chain anyway. I'm a vegetarian, and
right.
That helps out
so
tremendously. Yeah, because radiation doesn't concentrate. And so that's, you know, the first piece of advice I'd have. And the second is, you know, just be aware and be wake up. Susan, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. Dan in Koshokian, Ohio. Dan, we have a minute to the end of this hour, and it's all yours.
Okay, just one quick comment I wanted to make. I was watching this morning, and I heard the comment that was made that the parable of talents people use that as a pretext for capitalism.
Right.
The problem with a lot of these people, they take the Bible out of context. If a person, the answer I would give to a person like that, Jesus' description of the rich man in Luke chapter 12 and his description of the sheep and goats in Matthew 25 would answer that.
Of course it would.
That's what you're supposed to do.
He wasn't talking about money. He was talking about spiritual riches. He said, if you're in a position to help other people, you should do that. And the person to whom much is given, much is expected. And the person who has the greatest ability to help others has an obligation to help others in the greatest way. And, you know, create a better world. Create, you know, and advocate for the sick and for those in prison. And you know, yeah. You know, thank you, Dan. Good to know I'm not crazy here. Amazing. So we will continue. This is going to get even more interesting here in just a moment when Peter Ferrara drops by, the kind-hearted director of entitlement and budget policy at the Heartland Institute, to tell us all about entitlement reform.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Peter Ferrara on the line with us, the attorney and senior fellow with the Heartland Institute, heartland.org, the website. And Peter, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. You are pitching personal prosperity accounts. I take it this is the GOP's latest plan to get our Social Security?
This is the part of the broad entitlement reform under which we solve the entitlement crisis and the entire fiscal crisis with no benefit cuts for seniors or the poor. In fact, they would do better. We structurally reform all these programs to rely on savings, investment, incentives, and competition so we can do far more with a lot less. So seniors or the poor do better. The modernized entitlement programs serve them better. Part of this includes the Hartman plan, in fact, and yet at the same time, this government spending over the long run is reduced by 50%.
Okay, Peter, let's just go through some of these, and I'd like to go through these in the context of you know, basic moral values, this being the holiday season. Let's start with loyalty. It seems to me like we should be loyal to people who have already paid into the system. A person who retired in October of 2008 and had put 35 years of their money into the stock market instead of Social Security would have lost $26,000 compared to what they would have gotten in Social Security if they had the stock market in the United States perform like a Japanese stock market performed over that same time, and we seem to be moving in that direction. That person who retires after 35 years would have lost $70,000. So why do we want to screw retirees?
There's no benefit cuts in any of this. We addressed this all in the, I believe this is in the spectator.org column, but I worked with Bill Shipman from State Street Global Advisors, and we did a
well, real simple question. If you retired after 35 years in 2008, you would have lost $25,000 if your money had been in the stock market as opposed to Social Security. Why are you proposing a program that moves people's money out of the Social Security Trust Fund and into the stock market?
Or not? Do you want me to answer that question or not?
Well, your answer was go read something, and I'm asking you for the actual answer.
I was going to tell you what was in that thing that you should go read.
Okay.
I was backing it up with a place where you can actually go read it.
That's
fine.
You can
read it at spectator.org. Colin, you can read it in my book, America's Ticking Bankruptcy Bomb. The article was published actually in the Wall Street Journal.
Okay.
And we went back and looked at the actual performance of the stock market. Suppose you had somebody who'd saved and invested in one of these personal accounts over their entire lives, and they retired just after the financial crisis. What would their results have been? And they would have retired with almost $1 million in their accounts. In fact, they were millionaires, but they lost 37% of the value of their accounts in the last year, which is after the worst 10 years in stock market history. And what they had in the account was still enough to pay them 75% more than Social Security even promises them, let alone what they could pay. Now, this is a choice.
Well, doesn't
Nobody
that depend on how long they live?
No, it doesn't depend on how long they live.
But wait a minute, Peter. That's a fixed amount, and Social Security is a pension. It pays you regardless of how long you live. So for you to come up with those numbers, you had to have some age of death, some assumed age of death.
Go look it up in the dictionary, annuity, and you still seem to be familiar with that financial concept. But an annuity, you take a fixed amount of money, in return you get a benefit for the rest of your life, however long you live.
You're right. You're right. Okay, so an annuity works very much like Social Security. So you're suggesting that instead of people putting money into the equivalent of a 401k, which is a defined benefit plan, I mix up my words on these all the time. So basically a 401k where what you get out is what you put in plus, you know, whatever it made or lost in the stock market. You're suggesting that this be put into an annuity run presumably by an insurance company who probably is going to invest their money in the stock market. How do you know that the annuity is going to perform that well?
Well, you just do the calculation in a standard long-term market investment return, and over an entire life period, you have lots of ups and downs. And you have some terrible years, and you have some fantastic years. But over an entire lifetime, it averages out.
But it depends on when you retire. I mean, you know...
No, actually, it doesn't. You will always get more from a lifetime of savings and investment than a lifetime of no savings and investment.
Well, I'll agree with you on that. Why is Social Security not sacred to you?
Well, we're offering something better than Social Security. It's a choice.
Yes, if you took all the money that goes into Social Security and you put 100% of that into the retirement part of Social Security, probably people would end up, let me finish my sentence here.
That's not going to work. Everything you said up to now is false.
Okay, but it's not, I'm not going where you think
You're
I'm going.
You're wasting my time.
So I'm not going where you think I'm going, and you can correct me when I'm done. If you took all that money, and instead of putting it into retirement benefits, which we've been talking about up to this point, let's keep in mind, a third of all Social Security payments are not for retirement. They're for people who are literally widows, orphans, and disabled people.
Yes.
How does that change your math?
The math takes that all into account. And so under the full plan, and also this is all proven, it's all worked in the real world. I gave three examples in my book of where this has actually worked in the real world.
Where, for example?
In the United States of America. Chile, Galveston, Texas, and the Federal Thrift Savings Plan. You could, because those alternative
Peter, you know, Chile is melting down right now.
Can I explain it to you? Those alternative benefits are financed by, you can do, in addition to the savings and investment, you have insurance. So part of the money is used to buy life insurance to buy the survivor's benefit. Part is used to buy disability insurance to pay the disability benefit. And then, and so all those benefits continue, and they're actually better in the private sector than the Social Security promises.
So what happens though if you go into the private sector and you're trying to buy disability benefits, and they say, oh wait a minute, you're a cancer survivor, or oh wait a minute, you've had hepatitis C, or oh wait a minute, you've had lupus or something. You really think that they're going to help you out? And by the way, Chile is going down the tubes in terms of their their Social Security program.
Best it was, thing ever happened to working people.
It was imposed upon them in 1981 by a dictator.
It was a choice.
The average rate of return on individual accounts from 1982 to 1986 was 15.9%, which sounds great, but when you take out the commissions for the private for-profit companies that run Chili's system, the return was 0.3%. The returns from 1991 to 1995 averaged 12.9%, which sounds great, but after you take out the management fees, it was 2.1%. For a new worker enrolling in 1996, the 3.5% gross yield actually amounted to a minus 6.8% return after the management fees. I mean, are you?
It's inaccurate. Look, everybody, they all made, 97% of the workers made the choice one by one for this private system.
They didn't really make a choice. You had a dictator who forced it on them. It was Pinochet.
That's inaccurate. Why do you sit there and make stuff up all day long?
You don't think Augusto Pinochet was a military dictator?
I'm listening to you like you do the intro, and 90% of what you say is factually inaccurate. And people listen to you who want to hear fantasies and don't want to hear facts, and I guess that's what they get out of your show.
Under the program that Pinochet put into place, you were required to contribute 10% of your wages to this government-approved investment program that was run by for-profit corporations. You know that.
You were perfectly free to stay with the old system if you wanted. 3% of the workers did make that choice. When the chief actuary of Social Security scored Paul Ryan's legislation for personal accounts, he concluded, a career bureaucrat, that 100% of American workers would choose the personal accounts because they were so obviously a better deal than Social Security. He knows much more about it than you do. That's posted on the website.
I disagree. I think I know more about this than Paul Ryan does.
No, this is the chief actuary of Social Security, and he knows
Paul Ryan
about it.
Paul Ryan is a shill for the insurance companies and the banksters on Wall Street. He has dinner with a $300 bottle of wine with a guy worth billions who's a hedge fund manager. I can see that handwriting on that wall, Peter.
It's the chief actuary of Social Security, not Paul Ryan. But you're not following the argument, so you don't know. You don't understand. But the chief actuary of Social Security...
Wouldn't privatization... making personal attacks when you can't answer the question doesn't work, Peter. Wouldn't privatization put all of this in the hands of the one...
I haven't started personal attacks with you, my friend. I haven't started them yet.
Okay. All right, well, we're out of time, Peter. We'll have to allow the personal attacks for some other day. Peter Ferraris, attorney, senior fellow at the Heartland Institute, and the guy who has figured out how to save Social Security. You can read all about it at heartland.org. I do not mean that facetiously. Peter, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
You're welcome.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. The post office is screwed back with that and your calls.
I'm all right. Nobody but about me. Why you got to give me a fight? Can't you just let it be?
Oh, this is amazing. So Donald Trump, first of all, this is what John Huntsman had to say. Clip number two, Jacob. This is what John Huntsman had to say about the whole Donald Trump December 27th reality TV Republican debate.
Well, I'm not going to kiss his ring, and I'm not going to kiss any other part of his anatomy. This is exactly what is wrong with politics. It's show business over substance. If he had any courage at all, he would be running for president of the United States of America as opposed to manipulating the process from the outside. This is about real issues. It's not about show business. The presidency of the United States of America is more important than these silly game shows and reality shows.
Yeah. So basically, and Ron Paul said basically the same thing. He's not going to play. He's not going to be part of, a circus that Donald Trump does. So Donald Trump just came out, and Louise, what was the word he used? Okay, Donald Trump just came out and said that Ron Paul and John Huntsman are a joke. Donald Trump calling somebody a joke. It's Louise, may I tell the story of the correspondence dinner and what you said? May I have your permission when you walked up to Donald Trump? When you walked up to Donald Trump? It's okay? All right. So we're at the correspondence dinner, right? Where the president comes and they make these jokes, and he made a lot of jokes about Donald Trump that night. And beforehand, we're downstairs and with the hoi polloi, whatever. I'm wearing my tuxedo. and Louise is with me. And we're at the Washington Post pre cocktail party. Okay. And Donald Trump walks in with like his two or three security guards and his wife on his arm and a couple of very attractive women with him. And my wife grabs my arm and starts going through the crowd and saying, I'm going to have a look. And she gets up about a foot and a half from his face, and his security guard looked like he was going to jump on her. And she takes a good hard look, and then she turns to me and she says, plug's gone wrong. And everybody around us is going, is like half of them are laughing and the other half are trying to pretend that they didn't hear her say that. Anyhow, at this point, we need to put all the Republicans on an island with Trump because it's all become a joke by the Republicans and by the media. It's pretty much there now. Let's just let Trump pick, right? Any Republicans out there disagree? Call me. Trump has actually said he's going to pick. He's going to, after his little reality TV show on December 27th, minus Huntsman and Ron Paul, and we haven't yet heard if Mitt Romney is going to participate or not. So far, the only guy who says he's going to participate is Newt Gingrich. After this, Donald Trump says he's going to endorse a candidate. Gee, I wonder how that's going to work. It's pretty amazing. I mean, you know, it's really pretty amazing. Marty in Craig, Colorado. Hey, Marty, what's on the mind? Oh, what's on your mind? Thanks,
hello, Tom.
Thanks for being on the line. What's up?
Well, thank you, and thank Free Speech TV, my favorite.
There you go.
Let me preface, but I live in a 98% Republican county.
Okay.
So you could just imagine some of the editorials make your head explode. Anyway, I got a robocall from Newt Gingrich mentioning the failed secular socialist societies of Europe, along with a few other things about how he worked with Clinton to end welfare and several more misinformations. So it sounds to me like he wants a theocracy.
So that's interesting. So you got a robocall from Gingrich. He's decided that he's going to actually, because up until this point, Gingrich has not been running a campaign. He's been doing book signings and and speeches where he's paid to speak, but he has no campaign apparatus. He doesn't have local offices in the various states. And now, and there was a piece in the New York Times this morning about this, all of a sudden he is scrambling because there's actually a possibility that he could end up the nominee. And to do that, he's got to build a campaign base, you know, a nationwide campaign base. And so you got a robocall in Craig, Colorado. So it appears that at the very least, they're starting to build the infrastructure. That's fascinating. Marty, thanks for the heads up on that. That's very interesting. Albert in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Albert, what's up?
Hi, Tom. The Republican nomination process has become a joke. The Republicans in Congress have blocked every thing that's that the Democrats have tried to put forth in order to bring this country back from the brink.
For 3 years.
In this next election, there's a good chance that close to 50% of the people are going to vote Republican and possibly elect a Republican president. Could you just speak to that about the American public?
Well, I think it's a sad commentary on the fact that our media, I mean, I refer you to, if you go over to Talking Points memo, Josh Holland wrote back in August about the Murdoch primary. Rachel Maddow did a really nice piece on her MSNBC show a couple days ago about that. You can probably find without too much trouble. And basically, Rupert Murdoch controls the political system in the United Kingdom. He decides who's going to be the prime minister, and because he owns so much of the media in the UK. Now, in the US, he doesn't own so much that he can decide who's going to be president, but he owns enough that he can decide who's going to be the Republican nominee. And he's going to decide what he and the Koch brothers, between the two of them, they're going to decide what the Republican positions are going to be. So, you know, and this is all the result, frankly, of Supreme Court rulings that have made it, that have, and Reagan's no longer enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and Clinton signing the 1996 Telecommunications Act, that have allowed these huge, massive consolidations of power to happen. So, you know, I think that the solution to this is very straightforward. We need a constitutional amendment that says corporations aren't money and speech isn't, and money. Corporations are people, and money isn't speech.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And then on top of that, we need to start enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act again. Break up the big banks. Break up the big in every industry, including the media. That's the good, the bad, and the very, very cerebrosely ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com. It helps my brain say big words and debate conservatives. The good. John Huntsman. Huntsman declined an invitation to attend the Republican debate in Iowa at the end of the month, hosted by Newsmax and moderated by none other than the Donald. In a statement today, Huntsman said about Donald Trump, "I'm not going to kiss his ring, and I'm not going to kiss any other part of his anatomy. This is exactly what is wrong with politics. It's show business over substance. The presidency of the United States is more important than these silly game shows and reality shows." He's right. Unfortunately, Republican voters seem to prefer the silly games, hence why John Huntsman is polling in last place. The bad. Eric Cantor. The House Majority Leader is the man behind the Republicans' You Cut initiative, which allows Americans to vote online what programs of the federal government they'd like to see cut. On Eric Cantor's chopping block this week, Smokey the Bear. That's right, Eric Cantor wants to do away with Smokey the Bear. Smokey gets funding from environmental literacy programs run out of the Forest Service Department, and cutting these programs would save a mere $5 million a year, or just about 1/3 millionth of our debt. Cantor defends the cut on the UCut website, writing, "While students may benefit from some of the outdoors activities these programs provide, using taxpayer dollars to generate issue-oriented advocacy among school children and college students is inappropriate." Next up, Republicans will probably target McGruff the crime dog. And the very, very ugly Sheriff Joe Arpaio. When it comes to illegal immigration, Sheriff Joe is tough as nails. When it comes to children being molested, he's as soft as a Snuggie. The AP is reporting that over a three-year period, Sheriff Joe's office failed to adequately investigate more than 400 sex crimes with some victims as young as 2 years old. According to a detective in the city of El Mirage, when Arpaio's office was notified of these crimes, quote, "there was no follow-up reports, no collection of additional forensic evidence, and zero effort made after the initial report of the crime was taken. They put their feet on the desk, and that was that." So it looks like America's sheriff has some explaining to do, and that's very, very ugly. I should add, I read the article on that. Most of those kids were the children of illegal immigrants, which might have something to do with it, with why Sheriff Joe is looking the other way. It's just incredible. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And John in Wilmington, Delaware. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Fine. What's on your mind, sir?
I'm kind of outraged that nobody's speaking out about this National Authorization Defense Bill. Act, it's Bill 1867, basically erodes our right to due process.
Right. Yes and no. The original Senate version could have been interpreted as saying that if the president designated you as Al-Qaeda and the president asserted that he had evidence that you were trying to harm American citizens, he could have you arrested and thrown in jail forever as an enemy combatant without trial, without the right to defend yourself, without lawyers, all those kind of things, which is obviously, you know, clear violations of the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th Amendments of the Constitution. The Senate then passed a rider to it, or an amendment to that piece of legislation, which said that, however you interpret this bill, it does not change existing law. So, in other words, they were saying, you know, maybe the language could be interpreted that way, but we're going to attach a piece of legislation to this saying that you will not interpret it that way. Now, the problem is that the House bill clearly says that the president can do that. So now these two bills have to be reconciled in conference committee, and there will be a new piece of legislation that comes out of that, because when the House and Senate have different laws to do the same thing, they have to end up with the same kind of the same law word for word, so it could be passed by both the House and Senate and sent to the president for his signature. The president has already said if it says that he has the power to imprison people forever, he will veto it. And so, you know, let's hold off our hysteria until the House Senate Conference Committee. But in the meantime, I'm with you. It is worth calling your two senators and your one member of the House of Representatives and the comment line at the White House. You can find all those at callcongress.org. It's worth calling them and saying, in the defense appropriation bill, please do not make the United States and the rest of the world a battlefield in the war on terror forever and ever. And please do not give the military the right to arrest me simply because the president thinks I'm a bad guy, because that's the bottom line. And you're right on that. Cora in Taos, New Mexico, listening on KVOT. Hey, Cora, what's up?
Well, I was going to say about the American Family Association, if they would hearken back to the days of the Pilgrims. When the Pilgrims washed up on these shores, they were a pretty austere sect.
Yes.
And if somebody tried to do business selling Jesus, I think they would have seen a mob with the pitchforks and the torches.
Well, we didn't even celebrate Christmas in the United States until the late 19th century.
Right.
Because
it was considered blasphemous.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we celebrated the holiday, families celebrated the holiday, but it was not commercialized. There was, you know, Santa Claus as a cartoon character came along in the late 19th, early 20th century. You know, certainly at the time of the Pilgrims, I believe, didn't celebrate any religious holidays because they thought that was, you know, dancing, singing, all those things were forbidden to the Pilgrims and the Puritans. And
that's why they landed up over here, because England didn't like them anymore.
Right. Well, because they tried to impose that on England. I mean, that was the whole Cromwell thing, you know, and the people of England said, hey, you know, we'll take the king back if it means we can drink and dance and sing again. And, you know, so that's, but anyway, good point. Excellent point, Cora. Thank you for calling and making it. Mark in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Tom, as I see it, we need a campaign against all the pledge takers to Grover Norquist in this next election, senators and congressmen up for reelection.
I'm with you. Why would you make an oath to a lobbyist when the oath that you take as a member of Congress explicitly says that no other oath shall supersede your oath to the Constitution?
Tom, as I see it, if I was running against one of these candidates, that would be what I would run my campaign on, and he signed a pledge to the 1% of this country.
Yep.
And the problem is, if we can get rid of this Grover Norquist pledge and make it a pariah for people to sign it, we can change the direction of our government in this country. And if we, you know, what's at stake here is the middle class, Tom.
Yep.
They're going to keep gouging us until we can break this pledge and all these people that sign them.
I'm with you, Mark, and I sure hope that a bunch of Democratic strategists are listening. Norquist needs to go to the island, Louise says. Put him on the show with the Donald. Rick in Mayfield Heights, Ohio. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm fine. What's up?
I just got one question. If they privatize the post office, what does that do to the federal mail fraud laws?
That's a good question. I think they probably go away. I don't think that they apply to UPS and FedEx. But I honestly don't know. You know, and I don't even want to contemplate it. Privatizing the post office. This is an institution that was created by Ben Franklin before the country was even a country. And in fact, it's one of the few institutions that's actually mentioned in the Constitution. The rationale in the Constitution for giving states and the federal government the power to build roads was so that the post office could travel on them. And, you know, so this poison pill that the Republicans put in to destroy the Postal Service, because it is the largest unionized employer in the United States, should not stand. And there are legislative efforts to undo that requirement that the post office fund 75 years worth of health retirement benefits over a 10-year period to the tune of $5 to $6 billion a year, and it does need to be fixed legislatively. And so far it's not been, and frankly I think it should be. Paul in Nelson, Nebraska. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Not too much, but I wanted to talk to you about the parallel of the USA and the Europe problems that we have with the money.
Sure. It all goes back to Milton Friedman.
Yes. Just recently I was visiting with someone who travels Europe a lot, and I says, do they always, in various stores, I says, are the Chinese products quite available? And he says, yes, a lot.
Yes.
And so I drew this conclusion that there's a parallel between the USA and Europe jobs, and that's why United States doesn't have any jobs anymore, because we sent everything over there to China.
Right, and the Europeans have done much the same, and many of the low-wage countries, Italy used to be a low-wage country in Europe, and many of those jobs have also gone to China. Excellent point, Paul, and thanks for calling and making it. Woody in Reno, Nevada. Hey, Woody, what's up?
Good show, Tom. I have a little words I'd like to say about Social Security, my feelings about it, if I may.
Very quickly, please. We have a minute.
Yes. My golden years have turned to rust. Politicians I did trust.
Okay. that's a bumper sticker.
And I got a good one here, too.
Okay.
I watched that old picture the other night, saw you in green, and I just wonder if that's a Republican's answer to Medicare.
Yeah. The Republican answer to Medicare is really simple. It's what the people shouted when they asked Ron Paul the question, you know, what would you do if a person was injured and didn't have health insurance, and somebody from the audience shouted, let him die. That's the Republican answer to Medicare. And, you know, Woody, I think you nailed it there. And it is.
I have another one, too, about these Republicans running for president. Ronald Reagan made a statement one time to a group of people. I think it applies here. He said, this is the biggest gathering of Looney Tunes I've ever seen.
Really? Ronald Reagan said that?
That's right.
Boy, would I love to have a tape of that. Woody, thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. We'll be back with more of your calls and more news of the day. Are the Baxters going to have their day in court? Martha Coakley thinks so. So I'll tell you about that right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And as noted earlier, the crisis of Fukushima continues. Do you think that Louise should let me take the Geiger counter out of my jacket, walk around with it?
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Talk media for the sane among us, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. Talk Radio News, brought to you by the new book Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman, as represented by Victoria Jones, who is at the White House. And I understand you're here an hour late, Victoria, because the president had something to say.
He did, yes. He came into the Brady Press briefing room and spoke to reporters today, urging congressional Republicans to extend the soon-to-expire payroll tax cut, saying that failure to do so is going to cost the average family about $1,000 next year, and that nearly 160 million Americans are soon going to see their taxes rise. He's saying, again, as he said the other day, now is not the time to slam on the brakes, now it's time to step on the gas. Also saying not to do so would be a self-inflicted wound. He said it's the right thing to do. He also said that some Republicans who he said have signed a pledge not to raise taxes ever in their lifetime, which he said sarcastically, say that they've always insisted on not paying for tax cuts. He said, forgive me for a little bit of confusion, and also pointed out that they changed the rules so that tax cuts don't have to be paid for, and pointed out that they had raised when they had done tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans previously, that had got us into the hole that we were in. So that he says, you know, they're in favor of tax cuts when it suits them, but they're not in favor of tax cuts for the middle class.
Yeah, or another way of saying it would be they're in favor of tax cuts for the top 1%, but they're not in favor of tax cuts for the bottom 99%.
Right. And then after he left the White House press room, his staff unveiled a countdown clock to the end of the year with days, hours, minutes, and seconds, saying middle class taxes will increase if Congress doesn't act. And that is on the briefing wall.
That's incredible. So and you were right there in the room with him when he did all this.
Oh, yeah, I was there. I was watching. Yeah.
You're a pretty good observer of people, and you've been in that room with that president since day one, many, many times. Do you think that he's, and he's playing political chicken here with this thing,
yeah,
clearly. Do you think that he is of steely resolve and is going to shove this thing down their throats? Or do you think that, as has happened on a few occasions in the past, he's going to flinch at the last minute?
Well, on a few occasions he's flinched. On a few occasions he hasn't. No, I don't think he's going to flinch. But I don't think that the what is perceived as a huge surtax on millionaires and billionaires is going to happen, because we're now getting leaked details of Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid's proposal, the compromise proposal that he's introducing this afternoon, which I'll give to you, which I think the president will, of course, get behind. And I think it was orchestrated that the president would get out in the Brady Press briefing room just before Harry Reid gets out on the Senate floor and introduces his proposal.
Right. My understanding is he's going to drop the surtax on millionaires after the first $1 million from 5% down to 2.5% or 3%, and it's only going to be for 10 years.
3.25% is going to be less than 2%, and it will sunset after 10 years.
Right. That's still going to be, and plus they're going to means test, what was it, Medicare or Social Security?
They're going to means test Social Security, food stamps
for
millionaires. Okay. But he won't require high earners to pay higher Medicare premiums, as Republicans had also suggested. But this is the beginning of the negotiations.
Right. But still, he's going to ask people who earn over $1 million to pay an extra $2 on 100? Is that 2%? Is that what I heard you just say?
It's 2%, less than 2% on $1 million.
Right. So on their first $1 million, they pay no additional taxes.
Right.
But if they make $100, $1,100,000 on that $100 that they make after their first million, they're going to pay $2 in taxes.
Correct.
And that is too much for the Republicans.
That is too much for some Republicans. Now, we'll see whether it continues to be too much. Now, John Boehner, of course, is saying that he thinks the payroll tax needs to get done. It's a good idea. And all Republicans in the House met in the basement of the Capitol on Friday. That's when they were told, look, you want to get home in 2 weeks, then cut a deal. You want to be here until the 23rd. That's another 2 weeks, then be intransigent and don't cut a deal. So we'll see how people feel about this, whether they are absolutely bound and determined not to raise taxes under any circumstances. Democrats are thinking that they have the wind in their sails on this millionaire's tax.
Well, they do. The vast majority of Americans are going, hey, wait a minute, these guys were paying 3% more during the Clinton years, and the result was we had a booming economy and a balanced budget. And now they're paying 3% less, and we're talking about raising, not even raising their taxes like Clinton did. I mean, he raised their taxes on all their income, not after $1 million. I mean, this is a flaky fraction of the tax increase that Clinton put into place. And the vast majority of Americans are saying, of course. In fact, a lot of millionaires are saying, of course, tax
reform. That's right. That's right. This is what's so interesting. He's making, Reid is making some other adjustments also. He's also going to reduce the payroll tax paid by employees to 3.1% from the current 4.2%. And that will shrink the package's cost from $265 billion over 10 years to about $180 billion. So that will make a difference in the cost as well. And there will also be spending cuts to non-health mandatory programs that were discussed during negotiations by the super committee. Don't know what they are.
But
so
could that be military spending?
There's no discussion of military spending.
Of course. Tragically. Okay. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st, by Ellen Ratner and Anne Gaiman. And thanks so much for being with us today. Don't forget, democracy begins when you get out there and get active. Up tomorrow, by the way, Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura will drop by. That should be entertaining. Don't forget, democracy begins when you get active. Tag, you're it. Occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.